There. Now we're ready.
All right. You have the handout, and this is on. This is the first time we've had a class called The Spirituality of the Elder and Deacon, I think. So I'm flying by the seat of my pants. But I do have a handout for you. I think you all have it. But I have this to say before we get started. This is probably the easiest lesson, simply to give you a list of do's and don'ts. Thus, heaping guilt and shame on the unqualified, and if you don't do it, guess what we think about you? Weighing down the conscientious, if you really want to do the work, and worse, perhaps stoking the pride of the dutiful that's dotted every I and crossed every T. So I don't want to do that. Maybe I have a question for you. In your spiritual life, what gives you life? Is it an activity? Is it a relationship? Is it music? What is life-giving to you in your life where you don't feel sucked dry at the end of it? Well, I would like, at least for this first lesson, to be something that is enlivening. Some of this stuff can just suck you dry. And you go through these, you know, vices, virtues, what your home is to be like, your reputation. Okay, you know, anyway, try to make the best of it. All right. The typical pattern with Paul in his letters is to make statements of fact they're called in the indicative. You're just telling something that's true, and go from there to give imperatives. Therefore, here's what you do. And it's very important that we pay attention to the indicative. He's telling us who we are, y'all, as men in Christ. And two of the main things I want for this evening: justification and adoption. Justification, with our guilty sods, we have been declared not just innocent, but righteous before the living God that knows all secrets. We have the righteousness of Jesus. His perfect obedience has been given to us. That's how our Father sees us. We're righteous, as hard as that is to believe. The second thing, he's done more than that. Justification is just a legal status, okay? A guy getting out of prison has his record cleared, maybe, okay? Well, we're on the same level. But adoption is different. It's more than relief from punishment and guilt that justification provides. It is a legal declaration of sonship, that God Almighty has done everything needed to make us his sons, his children. And we don't call him, O great King, O great ruler and leader and creator. We call him Father, just like Jesus does. And we can come to him. He says, I love you. I've made you part of my family. And it's more than just relief, y'all. It's life. It's life-giving. It's a warm, life-giving relationship with God. It's interesting in the history of this idea of adoption, the parts of the church that have really developed this in like creedal statements, written books on it, have been the Presbyterians. Scottish Presbyterians and Southern Presbyterians, especially in the years before the War of Northern Aggression. And they have lots. I want to recommend a book. I don't know if you like to read this kind of stuff, but John L. Jarrodot grew up on a very large plantation, several thousand acres off the coast of Charleston. Grew up, all his playmates were black. They worked the farm. And he grew up in a Christian environment. And I don't know. It seemed people that write on him say that he really traced it to his relationship to the slaves. They were his best friends. And then when he grew up and went to be a pastor of a church, you know who came in Charleston? Slaves. They'd be let off on Sunday morning to go to church, and they ran. They ran to his church. Frost and I have been there to see it. It had a wraparound balcony where the whites sat. How about that? And the floor was just front to back, row, 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 and it was packed. People sitting in the windowsills. They had to open the doors on the sides for his congregation of black slaves. And they were drawn because he preached the gospel. The largest church in Charleston, one of the largest in the South. And he taught them about their adoption. Dr. Doug Kelly has written on this. Doug is a South Carolina boy. And he cites Jarrido. He says, he cites a couple of Southern writers. He says, for one, he says, failing to take account of adoption in connection with our regeneration, being born again, would be like giving one the rights of a child without giving the spirit of a child. Jarrido writes, justification does not of itself entitle us to an inheritance. Adoption does. Justification conveys a title to the rewards of moral government, but adoption gives us to the title of sons. Jarrido goes on one more, and I'll hush about this. The scriptures make a difference between justification and adoption. The scriptures treat adoption as something over and beyond justification. You know, that's important. That's a huge deal. And that's the way it's treated in the Westminster Standards. How about that? Adoption accomplishes something distinctively different from that achieved by justification. We're made sons, sons of God. We can call him our Father. So, I want to avoid heaping guilt and shame on my brothers.
Sorry, I'm late.
Or way down there. Yeah, go ahead, get it out. You know, I don't want to weigh down those who have tender consciences, and I don't want to give fuel for the pride of the dutiful, okay? We're sons of God, and we may revel in that. All right, okay. That's all your advertisements. Now on this sheet, okay? I need to go through this. There are five main categories of qualifications for office in the church. The first one is proven integrity of character. All right? The key word for office holders is dignity. You know? It is used in 1 Timothy. The elders, deacons are to be dignified. The noun form is translated godliness. Interesting. The verb form is found in 1 Timothy 5:4, meaning practice piety, dignity. It's first of all listed for office bearers. And it's interesting there in 1 Timothy 3, how Paul deals with this. It's like vices and virtues. So 1 Timothy 3, and I'm just going to try to whip through this stuff, y'all. 1 Timothy 3, beginning with verse 8, deacons, likewise, are to be men, dignified men, worthy of respect, so forth. All right. So let's look at vices listed there. They are not to be certain things. Okay, notice not indulging in much wine. That's why we don't have any liquor here in this room. Afraid y'all would overdo it. We're not pursuing dishonest gain, so forth, so on. Okay? Vices, let's see. I brought the wrong Bible. It's not in conjunction with my notes. They're not to be double-tongued, okay, speaking out of both sides of their mouths. Their tongue is to be governed by truth, of course. A deacon, an elder, may not be dishonest in his speech. Think of Sapphira in Acts 5, verse 8. Drop dead for lying. Early church, what would that, how would that be? Next deacon meeting, somebody stand up and you hear a thud. Good night. Notice they're not to be addicted to much wine. Doesn't say a total abstainer at all. But on the other hand, not to be given to drunkenness. Okay? A deacon, an elder, is to be temperate. Okay? See Nabal in 1 Samuel 25, a drunken louse. And he ended up falling off a fence and breaking his neck. And set his good-looking wife free so she could marry David. That's how that worked. All right, it says also, not fond of sordid gain. All right. Don't know what your version has. Sordid, that's kind of the old King James language. It's from the Latin meaning filth or foul, vile kind of thing. A covetous person wants to be adding to his possessions. All right, don't want a deacon noted with that reputation. He must be above suspicion in handling the purse strings of the church. I remember at Chula, Mississippi, our first church I served, is in the Delta, Mississippi. Had one red light that the city council cut off at night. Didn't want to pay the electrical bill, so they cut it off. So they cut it on in the morning, and so yeah, I remember we had a guy in the church. We had one deacon. I think we had three elders. But the one deacon, every winter, would have, let's say he would make a run to the coast and come back and let everybody know. And he had two grease racks in his garage, and he'd raise the grease racks to about waist high and wipe them off, basically. And we just had a couple of kegs of beer, and all the officers would be in there. It was a great time, a lot of fellowship. And just drinking beer off the grease rack and, making decisions for the church.
Sermon on Sunday has changed.
we need a local grease rack, y'all. So, plainly, these vices would cripple anyone that was trying to manage the affairs of the church, be an elder or deacon. So those are vices. Virtues, we're told... and again, in 1 Timothy 1 and 3, that they are to hold the mystery of the faith. Okay? The idea there is to eradicate false teachers. They were turned away at Ephesus. Can't have a clear conscience with that. They're described as making shipwreck of their faith. The deacons were to do the opposite. They were to hold to the mystery of the faith. Y'all, we've got a confession of faith that has stood the test of some time, a few centuries. Very articulate in the way the paragraphs are written. But there are things they're still a mystery. Okay? Paul writes... And so we go with what is clear, and we believe what is unclear, and try to embrace it in faith nonetheless. In the non-Christian culture in which Timothy and Paul were living, the term of the day referred to deep secrets. that only the initiated could understand. But this is not the meaning with Paul. No, he speaks of clearly revealed things which had been concealed. All right? The mystery of the faith, not our subjective feeling of trust, but an objective collection of truths. Things true about God, true about the world, true about ourselves. Okay? That's what he has in mind. And the deacon, elder, is to hold it. Hold on to the mystery of faith. That is to possess it, embrace it, cleave to it. And is to do so with a clear conscience. Okay? You know, if you get through this, survive my teaching, and you're elected by the congregation, you're going to be asked to take vows. Will you be able to take those vows with a clear conscience? Well, that's what we want. That's what I want, that you can take them understanding those vows, and when they come to you, you either say yay or nay. Okay? You do so before God and His people. Think of different times you've probably heard us talk about Athanasius, lived in the 3rd century. He was a deacon in North Africa. And he went toe-to-toe with a man commonly understood now as a heretic by the name of Arius. And they debated the person of Jesus. Arius said there was two people. There was one divine, one human. Athanasius said, "You're out of your mind. That's not what the Bible says. He was one person. We can't understand the blending." It wasn't blending. It was one physical being, yet divine and human being. That's what the issue was, how to articulate that. And y'all, our creeds today reflect Athanasius. And he was a deacon. A deacon in the early church in North Africa. Those who followed Arius are now called Jehovah's Witnesses. How about that? Okay. Well, verse 11 here in 1 Timothy 3 says, "In the same way their wives are to be." So there's a place for women helpers for deacons. Let me mention their vices and virtues. Their vices, they're not to be malicious gossips. Okay? The word malicious there is where we get our word diabolical. Or you probably heard diabolos. It's a word for the devil, a name for the devil. But that's the word translated malicious here. They may not be malicious gossips. Their virtues are, they're to be, notice, worthy of respect, temperate, trustworthy in everything. Temperate is the same word used for deacons there. And faithful in all things, or trustworthy, that reliable, somebody you can count on. Y'all, there are situations here at Trinity, I guess at any church, where the guys just need to back up. We need some feminine help here. And there are circumstances, and I don't know what the rest of the male staff would say. I don't know what I'd do without Becky Cannerday. Y'all, stuff happens. Things come up. Odd, weird relationships, or you find out sins. How are you going to handle that? What are you going to do with those situations? Well, we need godly women that would help us. Okay. Next thing, an uncompromised home situation in verse 12. A deacon must be a husband of one wife and must manage his children and household well. All right. Look, you don't have to raise your hand the last time you screamed at anybody inside your house. None of that. But it's the idea of being a pattern, okay? A pattern. It's not a perfect home. You'd be lying for sure. You know, I wouldn't vote for you if you were the only candidate. I wouldn't vote for myself if I was the only candidate. But it's your home is a pattern that's acceptable to others, a good model, okay, for others to imitate. And you know, it might be that you're the best model for conflict resolution, that you and your wife can fight well. How about that? You learn to fight well yet? I think Frost and I are still working on it some, but we're learning. We've come a longer way. We're not where we once were. All right. The idea here is any gross deformity or abnormality in the home, that sort of thing. All right. An uncompromised home situation. Y'all, again, there are situations where, you know, we got a lot of widows, or as my friend with the service station in Chula would say, widders. Got a lot of widders. And, you know, you need wisdom, grace, in caring for our mothers in the faith, our sisters, and to deal with them wisely. We have a couple of widows that are barely making it financially. Okay? Their husband died early. Now what? Well, they look here. I'm glad they do. And sometimes they'll call in tears. They don't know what to do, and they're in a mess. What are you going to do? Okay? All right. Fourthly, y'all might get out early. Proven ability to exercise authority. The end of verse 12, again. Let's see. Manage children, household well, and those who have served gain excellent. Well, you see the idea. A deacon's home is to be a pattern, children, household, so forth, characterized by a couple of things. Stability, okay? You don't want your family in a constant state of flux where, you know, well, I was mad on Tuesday. Guess I'll be mad on Friday, you know, or pouting or who knows what, all kinds of things. But some measure of steadiness. I think it's more difficult when you have children at home. You don't ever know what's going to happen when they come home from school. What happened? Or if you get a phone call from a teacher. So, but some measure of stability, okay, you want. Order as opposed to chaos and confusion, you know, where the kids don't know what's daddy going to do now, what's mama going to say. And there's unreliable, you know, in the relationships. You don't want that. Some order, no chaos or confusion. As opposed to a general atmosphere of tension, you'd like your home characterized by love and peace. Doesn't mean you don't fight. Doesn't mean you don't have quarrels or disagree with things. Doesn't mean that. But when you're dealing with it, you're loving each other. Okay? You know, I didn't believe that was possible. People, first time I heard somebody talk like that, I thought, you're out of your mind. I hadn't learned to fight. You know, it was either my way or the highway. And if Frosty was here, she'd say, yay and amen. And
your way was so great.
Richard, I wish I could say that.
She told me that.
Oh, yes. I have. I think what it took is me to learn to humble myself for my wife's better idea. So. All right. Love and peace. A place of rule and respect. You know, it's not a dominating spirit where somebody's just barking orders or someone demanding to wear the pants. Come on. Come on, we've got enough of that in the culture. We don't need it in the church. You don't want your children despising you and what you stand for because of the way you treat them at the house. Good grief. Well, even if they rebel, they will have to admit they still respect you. Okay? They may disagree and say, well, you know, you can jump in a lake. But there'd be a measure of respect. Okay. Fourthly, good reputation. Acts, the election of the deacons in Acts 6. Y'all have any questions? I'll cut the phone off. Okay. All right. Acts 6, verse 3. And apostles are giving directions for the election of men. He says, brothers, choose 7 men from among you who are known to be full of the Spirit and wisdom. And we will turn this responsibility over to them. Okay, I'm calling it a pervasive spirituality. That is, their relationship with God permeates everything about their lives. Your relationship with God is to permeate everything about your life, public and private. Full of the Spirit, it's the idea, Paul says in Ephesians 5, verse 18, about being filled with the Spirit, same term, so that there would be the presence of the Spirit made known through the fruit of the Spirit. Let's see. I think I brought something in here. No, wrong thing. Full of the Spirit and full of wisdom there in, again, Acts 6. The election of those men in Acts 6, they immediately had to deal with a delicate situation involving women with racial overtones. How about that? Grecian Jews. So you had all these racial tensions in the early church, and the deacons get to deal with it. Y'all jump right in there, guys. Can you imagine the very first situation they had, and it was that? Yet they dealt wisely. You know, there was no further complaint from the women nor the apostles. We even run across a woman later on by the name of Dorcas, Acts 9, who was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity. You know, wonder what the plural of Dorcas is. Dorcai? I think we have some Dorcai here in this church. And you need to get to know them and appreciate their gifts, you know, that God's given to us as a congregation. All right. Anyway, just as with the men, so these women would have a Christian spirituality that pervades their lives, public and private. All right. Any questions? Yeah, we're going to get out here early, aren't you? Not saying anything. Well, how about some practical lessons? Practical lessons. Got a couple there. This passage, 1 Timothy 3, and of course Acts 3, assumes that godly character is discernible. People can tell. They can see it. They've witness it in action. Okay? You can tell clearly those who have the qualifications. Something that is discernible, it means to see clearly or distinctly. You know, think of Jesus' words in John 7. He says, do not judge according to appearance. Well, we take that and think, don't ever judge. That's not what he says. The next part says, but judge, imperative verb, judge with righteous judgment. Don't be stupid about it. Don't be foolish. Judge righteously. Discern character. Who has gifts? Who doesn't? Who needs to wait? Who needs to be running in there? Okay? Godly character is discernible. I did not say that it will be discerned infallibly, absolutely, or consistently. But it will be discerned. Okay? All right. Comments, questions on that first one? All right. Secondly, this passage, 1 Timothy 3, teaches that provenness is the requirement for office, not potential. Verse 10. But they say, no, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong passage. 1 Timothy, I haven't got my books right. 1 Timothy 3 again, thinking of it. First, let them be tested. Okay? Yes. Tested. You know, put them in places of responsibility so you can see how that works out. How do they handle that? Ask them to come along with you. Help me with this sort of thing. You know, therefore, we should not subtract or add to God's requirements. We need to be careful of that. I remember being in a church where it was only Ole Miss graduates. Oh. Yeah, that was in another state, believe me. But it was just understood, you know, in small town, small southern town. Their thinking was, they'll know what to do. Deliver us all. Please. You know, there's nothing in the deacon list about teaching. Elders have that. It's required of an elder, not of a deacon. You know, we can bring on ourselves much trouble and unnecessary pain by putting men into office who are not qualified. It'll come back and bite you in the rear end. And it's often in a very public manner. Those who aspire to the office must be willing to be examined by the members of the church and the officers of the church. See if they can discern the character in you that's needed. Okay? All right. Provenness is the requirement for office, not potential. Notice thirdly, this passage gives encouragement to those who serve faithfully as deacons. Again, 1 Timothy 3:13. Those who have served well gain an excellent standing and great assurance. Isn't that interesting? Great assurance in their faith in Jesus Christ. Those who have ministered well. It's interesting. This verse isn't given about elders. Don't know why. Just didn't. What glamour is there in changing light bulbs, y'all? How many people in the church are going to know who locks up when everybody's gone? Or who was there early to get the air conditioning on in the summer, make sure things are cool in the classrooms? Probably no more than a handful. Your family. Why did Daddy have to leave? Can I go? There's little public recognition, especially for deacons. They tend to function on a low profile, just the nature of the work. You know, I don't know how many times, thinking of another lady, a widow, that Mike Hogg writes a check to her frequently because she can't pay her bills. Now, who all knows about that? Mike and you know, finance committee looking over the books, seeing where those checks go. All right. This lowly responsibility is of great pleasure in the sight of God. They're commended in Hebrews 6:10 that speaks of those having ministered and still ministering to the saints. And the root word there for having ministered and still ministering, the root word diakoneo, where we get deacon. That's what they're doing. All right. Well, so far you hadn't fallen asleep. I'll try another one. Fourthly, if the head of the church, the Lord Jesus Christ, has established the office for the good of his church, then he will raise up and equip those for the office. Ephesians 4, verses 7 and following, talking about the risen, ascended Christ lavishly throwing out gifts to his church in order to equip her. I love that picture of the giving of gifts. And it's the ascended Christ as Lord and King of all. And it's like in celebration, he's, you know, like Santa Claus in the Christmas parade, throwing out peppermint sticks to the kids. And, you know, Jesus is throwing out gifts to his church in celebration of his ascension on high. And one of the gifts is that of deacon, y'all. It's of serving. You know, if he hasn't at this point in your life, then you need to pray. Wait for him to do so. You know? If he has, as in John 12, verse 26, if anyone serves, diakoneo, serves me, then let him follow me. And where I am, there will be my servant, diakonos. Deacon. There will be my servant, my deacon. And if anyone serves me, my Father will be honored. It's amazing. People in the church may not know. God does. Jesus sees the secret things. His Father does as well. They take note. All right, lastly, these requirements for office remind us of Christ, who is the great deacon. Matthew 20, you know, think of the ordinary, mundane things Jesus did. People that their names aren't even mentioned in the Bible, but he reached out to them. Matthew 20 and verse 28 especially. Yes, this is the mother of the sons of Zebedee, the sons of thunder. She said, you know, my boys are pretty good. Put one on your right hand and one on your left when you come in glory. And Jesus didn't take a liking to that. But he did say, let's see, what verse was it again? 28. He says, whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to serve, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus is the great deacon, y'all. That means the great elder, too. Think of John 13, verses 1 to 9. Jesus is the one that kind of girds up his loins and takes a towel and a wash basin and washes the dirty, stinky, chafing feet of his disciples. That was for the lowliest slave in the house to do. And they didn't like it. Peter especially. Mouthy Peter, you know. Jesus had all the virtues and none of the vices. And he's the pattern for us in our living. Okay. Well, you survived. Any questions or comments? Okay, let me tell you one story from Jared Doe, again in Charleston.
What's the book called?
Oh, it's found it here. There's a life of Jared Doe. I forgot who wrote it. This is from Discussions of Theological Questions. Don't smoke if you read it. Parts are very dry. You'll both go up in flames. Okay. I left the other book, his biography, in my office. I'll try to remember to bring
it. What's the Don Kelly that you cited, the second?
Ah, yes. Volume 3 of his Systematic Theology. But it's quite good. The thing that happened with Jarrido mentioned he had the largest church in Charleston. It was all black slaves. The whites sat in the wraparound balcony. You can still go to that church today. It was Mount Zion. Frost and I have been there. Just amazing. But he, their deacons especially, were noted for their work. Can you imagine a slave culture and the kind of needs you would find, that you would have? There were some Christian slave owners around the Charleston area, and some were not, as to be expected. But often on Sundays, the Christian slave owners would let their folks off early. And even in the biography, Jarrido's biography, he said, it's just so moving to me that when it was time for church, he could hear their feet on the pavement running to church. Didn't have shoes, but you could hear their feet, hundreds of them, thousands of them, running to church. Mr. Jarrido was going to preach the gospel, and they wanted to be there. And Jarrido got into trouble initially with a Southern Presbyterian church for wanting to ordain elders and deacons that were black slaves. And I think they realized that they didn't have any standing to resist him when it was all over. But Jarrido was the first one to ordain black deacons in the Southern church. And he had black elders that went to Presbytery. Imagine they stood out quite a bit in their opinions. But they were noted. The war came, a war of Northern aggression. Jarrido was a chaplain for the Southern troops, was in a prisoner of war camp, virtually starved to death in a lice-infected place, was set free, and they had to walk home, and at the state line of North and South Carolina, there was a mob, hundreds of blacks. They weren't there for anybody else but one man, John Jarrido. They were free now, and they said, "We want you to come be our pastor, just like you were before the war." How about that? We don't hear stories like that. He loved them and they knew it. He gave them, he acknowledged their dignity and treated them with respect. They were real elders, real deacons. And Jarrido saw their gifts and fought to have them ordained. And they and the congregants, free, met him at the state line of South Carolina and carried him home back to Charleston. It's a wonderful story, y'all. Well, okay. Any comments or questions? How we do? Getting out early, man.